Aloha, I'm D.W. Gibson, in for Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, January 15th. We check in with Governor Green about immigration and rising healthcare premiums. Plus, we get his priorities heading into the legislative session. And do you have an emergency kit at home? We hear about easy steps we can all take to be better prepared for the unforeseen. On the Manu Minute, we learn about a large songbird respected for its mimicry. Plus, we hear from the author of a memoir about being trafficked for decades. It's a story of survival and resilience. And curious about new music? There's a new series at the Capitol Modern that might be for you. It kicks off this weekend. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm D.W. Gibson, in for Catherine Cruz. As the state legislature gears up for a new session, concerns about the cost of living are deepened by rising healthcare premiums for tens of thousands across the islands. There are also questions about how state and local law enforcement will interact with federal ICE officers. We checked in with Governor Josh Green this morning to get his thoughts on these and other pressing issues. You know, here on the show, we all have front of mind today the issue of immigration. Yesterday, we had a call-in show, and boy, we heard from a lot of people across the islands' feelings on the issue of immigration, particularly in the wake of the killing of Renee Nicole Good by an ICE agent in Minnesota. And I wanted to get your reaction to those events, but more specifically, get your reaction to the tension that we're now seeing between the federal investigation efforts and local law enforcement.
Yes. Well, the incident in Minnesota was tragic, and a person like Ms. Good or anyone should never be put in a circumstance where they have to face a violent moment, you know, whether it's with law enforcement or in any circumstance. So the ramping up of ICE activity is unfortunately creating these kind of moments. And we're hoping that there can be kind of a de-escalation of the whole process. We've been in touch with the Department of Homeland Security constantly, and our position is very clear. Local law enforcement should be doing what they do locally, which is taking care of crime and concerns. So they should not be working on immigration work, and that's why we don't authorize them to do that. Beyond that, the only time that we really feel that there should be some participation between, you know, the state of Hawaii and Department of Homeland Security on an immigration matter is if there's been a real criminal activity that, you know, merits someone leaving. So for serious criminals, of course, we support them being sent back to their home country. But everything else really should be much more peaceful. And we are a state that's built on immigration. We're mindful of our roots, and we want to honor them.
All right. So I want to switch gears and get your thoughts on the HMSA Hawaii Pacific Health merger. Any reaction to that proposed merger?
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts on it. Most of them will play out over the coming months. You know, first and foremost, healthcare is too expensive, and we still have access issues to healthcare, even though we're the best in the country. So we want to constantly be improving matters. It is going to be somewhat controversial. I have, you know, a lot of trust in all the partners that are considering coming together. However, we have to also respect the concerns that, say, Queens Hospital has or the HHSC system, that's Hawaii Health Systems Corporation. So my attorney general is being briefed and is talking to them already at length. Right now, it hasn't yet been determined which federal agency is going to look at the ramifications of a merger or a partnership. So that could be, you know, the FCC, it could be other groups. So we'll see. Once that's determined, then they will dive into the details, the specific details of what it would look like. We already are kind of a small family of healthcare plans. There's only a couple health insurers and only a couple healthcare providers. So whatever happens, we have to make sure that the providers are cared for, the doctors and nurse practitioners and PAs, so they can keep delivering care. That's the most important thing to me.
Yeah, and we've seen some positive developments in terms of healthcare on neighbor islands with the recent rural healthcare grant money and the expansion of facilities on a Hawaii island?
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting time, right? Because you have this proposal of a large merger, which would streamline administrative activities and theoretically decrease costs or decrease the rate of increase of costs. And at the same time, I was able to land this really large grant for Hawaii, which is the Hawaii Rural Health Transformation Plan. You know, our guys did a great job writing that up from my team, my executive staff, Healthcare Association of Hawaii leadership like Hilton Raethel. Just a lot of good input came from people. So this is $188.9 million per year times 5 years, so it'll be about $940 million. Look, we're going to be able to do some special things. I came to Hawaii with the National Health Service Corps to be a doc in rural Hawaii, so I'm very, very familiar about our needs. And this money can do stuff like help expand our rural health information network so that we can share notes and share people's care between the rural areas and the urban areas when people need specialists. It's going to do a lot more telehealth. And expanding telehealth to the rural communities is great because I was in the ER a lot of the time. And, you know, I would often need follow-up for patients from, say, a specialist or a surgeon, just a quick check-in, and telehealth can work for that. Then we're going to also enhance the number of providers we have. For instance, we want to expand the pipeline all the way back to high school facilities. So we've been working with the Healthcare Association already with scholarships and expanding those kind of programs all the way up and through medical school and residency. That program now will get funded much better because of this grant. And then finally, our rural health network for respite care. As you know, I need respite care for people that have been houseless but come out of the hospital and get sicker and they go back into the hospital and they cost a lot of resources and they suffer. So all of those things and then some more like the value-based care programs, they're going to be funded now. And I actually helped write this into the federal law because I saw the need when the federal guys were all kind of, you know, wrestling or struggling with what to do on healthcare. So I'm pretty optimistic about this, that it's going to help us. We got way more money than we thought we would. Originally, we, by population, would have only earned about $41 million in this grant. And we ended up getting 4.5 times that to almost $190 million.
Yeah, a significant sum indeed. And, you know, yesterday you announced the appointment of a new Public Utilities Commission chair. Tell us about that selection and what went into the decision.
So his name is John Inamora. He seems to be really well respected. He was the consumer advocate for a long time, so he has consumer kind of values and needs in mind. He also has a lot of government experience because he had worked on like the Campaign Spending Commission. You know, he's talented. He's a very nice guy. We're going to do a lot on energy in the coming years if people will continue to have me work at this job because affordability is our number one problem. It usually comes down to like housing and food costs, but also energy costs are really hard on people. So my energy plan, you know, expands our use of other sources of energy. We're always going to be most committed to solar and renewables, but we also need to look at everything that we can get some financing support for. And so I can't put my head in the sand while we have the current administration in there as they decrease the subsidies and support for solar, and they lean heavily towards, you know, these other sources of energy. I mean, they're pretty fossil fuel crazy, but I think we could do more geothermal. I think we could do some modest amount of liquid natural gas. And John is very familiar with all these things, really as a bridge to a fully renewable future. He knows that I'm absolutely committed to that. We have this goal in mind for 2045. It's in statute. I actually was the sponsor of that bill back long time ago, like in 2006. So this is our goal, to get there with a bridge. And John knows it. He knows a lot of the parties that have been, you know, petitioning the state for projects, and I think he's going to do a good job.
Speaking of the environment, the green fee, lots going on that front. We know that you've received recommendations in terms of how to use those funds. There's also the issue of the cruise ship industry and their challenge to this fee. Do you have worries that other sectors of the tourism industry will try to join the cruise ship industry's efforts to avoid paying the fee?
No. I worked that out with them in advance, so we have more than a good faith effort. They actually worked in support of the bill, so that's going forward. I think that the cruise ship industry is going to have to settle with us because the consequences are very bad for them otherwise, because we have to work together, and there's a lot of different levels in which we have to partner. You know, assuming they continue their activities here, we have to make sure that they have good infrastructure But we can only afford good infrastructure if we can protect the environment and have travelers here. So I made it very clear that they need to work with us. You know, we had over 600 public ideas that came to us. Ultimately, we're funding what amounts to about $126 million per year of incredible programs. It goes into three buckets. One's environmental stewardship. The other one is climate and hazard mitigation. And the final one is sustainable tourism. And that's going to mean a whole new generation of young environmentalists working on how to deal with climate change, how to make sure we're safer to avoid fires like we had in Maui, how we can preserve the shoreline and restore the beaches and parks. I mean, this is a pretty extraordinary moment where we have a fully funded stream of funding for years to come into perpetuity. But again, we're going to work out our differences with the cruise ships. I appreciate them. I respect them. But I also want them to acknowledge that the impact of a lot of individuals coming to Hawaii, whether it's on cruise ships or planes, it really ultimately still has to be considered. Because our residents were very clear with me when I was elected governor that we have so many travelers here that they have to bear a significant and proper share of the responsibility to keep Hawaii extraordinary. And that means resources, and that means investment. And that's what the green fee is.
Well, there's a big Supreme Court case coming up, Wolford versus Lopez, and it's going to take a closer look at a law that you signed regarding rules around carrying weapons. And to remind listeners, the law you signed largely flips the script on presumption of when and where firearms can be carried. The bill you signed requires posted signs when guns are allowed, establishing a presumption that guns are not otherwise allowed. The court has taken up a case that challenges this law. What are your thoughts as we head into those hearings?
I think guns cause a lot of harm. And I think as an ER doc who treated individuals who were shot and wounded or killed by gunfire, that this is no joke. And dropping lawsuits into states that are trying to keep their people safer is really callous and horrible. So I'm going to push back hard with my attorney general. You know, Hawaii has always been careful about gun carrying. We respect people's rights to bear arms, but that is not a carte blanche acceptance of the kind of guns that have, you know, evolved in society. And as a father who's watched gun violence near his children, I reject any kind of pressure from the gun industry that could make my people less safe. So I'm not playing around. They should go elsewhere with their lawsuits.
Well, one final question as we head into the new legislative session, wondering about your priorities. You recently released your proposed budget, which gives some indications, but what's front and center on your mind as we head into the new session?
Well, thank you for asking that. You know, what's front and center is affordability. We have crushing costs across the country, but of course, Hawaii is very expensive, and housing is our biggest driver of cost. So we're going to continue to promote affordable housing projects, public housing projects. That's critical to us. Healthcare is important, and that's another cost driver. That's why, you know, we will entertain the, you know, the partnership proposals, but we're also going to continue to like do all the things that you heard about on this rural healthcare transformation grant. Food costs are going to be supported. All of this goes to where we want all of our bills and policies to land, which is affordability. We're going to continue to build housing, and you know I'm under emergency housing rules for that purpose alone. The validation came from the Supreme Court. You'll see appropriations, of course, you know, $50 million in bonds for a new hospital, a medical center in Kona, all kinds of emergency healthcare services in that grant, climate resiliency. You know, we put in the largest tax breaks ever in our state for working families. But the parts that are going to be more difficult to afford going forward are for people who are a little bit more affluent, who got extra breaks from the federal government. So the current proposal is to leave everything in place. People keep all their tax breaks through 26, but the higher end cuts, especially that would help people that maybe had a little more money, they would be paused. We would take $1.8 billion back, and we'd reinvest $600 million into food security and childcare for working families. That's the plan. We do have a pretty good budget. We have been very careful with our money. I line itemed over $1 billion over the years to keep savings, and that's why we have $1.6 billion in the rainy day fund. But I'm going to use resources like that when necessary to keep things affordable in Hawaii while our economy improves. You're going to see a big boom in building, of course, because we need the housing. That helps our economy. There's a lot of other big issues out there that could potentially bring money here, perhaps in another conversation, we could dive into the proposals that deal with like online gambling and casinos, marijuana, all these other issues. But bottom line, I'm focused on affordability.
All right, Governor Josh Green, thanks for taking the time today.
You bet.
That was Governor Josh Green on immigration, healthcare, and affordability. We'll continue our coverage of the legislative session on opening day next Wednesday.
Support for HPR comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits committed to helping families of agricultural workers and retirees with affordable housing, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation, NereidHawaii.com.
The fantasy writer George R.R. Martin suffered an epic case of writer's block while trying to finish Game of Thrones.
We're not talking about being stuck for a day or a week or a month. We're talking about a matter of many years. And he's expressed great puzzlement because he was so productive for so long.
Why we fall into ruts and how to break free, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
So if you had to walk out of your house right now and you didn't know when or if you'd be coming back, what would you bring with you? HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote has been speaking with experts about what you should have in your go bag in case of a disaster, and she joins us this morning. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, DW.
All right. So I will confess, at this point, I think I have my driver's license, a copy of that, and maybe an electric bill at this point, proving some residency. Nothing beyond that. What am I missing?
Okay, well, that's actually a really good start.
All right.
Personal documents are some of the most important things, and also things that are commonly overlooked that you would need when you evacuated your home in a disaster. And I've been talking about this topic a lot with a group called Emergency Legal Responders. So they're a disaster rights organization, and they help people navigate legal challenges after a disaster. And I actually first got in touch with them after the Maui fires in 2023. And they say, as anyone who has experienced a disaster firsthand knows, the aftermath of an event like a wildfire or a hurricane is just like a legal and financial minefield. You have FEMA claims, you have insurance claims, all this paperwork that goes into rebuilding your life. And Amelia Hoppe, she co-founded Emergency Legal Responders. She's worked with a ton of people who lose important documents or personal information during a disaster. And she says not having access to that makes it a lot harder to rebuild your life. So ELR really encourages people to put important documents, like you've started to do with their license and a utility bill, in a go bag, something that you can quickly grab if you need to evacuate your home.
This also needs to be part of your disaster plan because, I can't tell you how much in the throes of a disaster, the last thing you want to be thinking about is where is my lease? Like, where is my custody paperwork when the other parent is coming in to say that I'm going to take the child? You know, how do I prove to this police officer that I live in this house and I need to be getting on this street because the street is now closed? So really, like, the emphasis on preparation and getting this all taken care of on the front end is not only going to save you time, money, it will be for your well-being and for those around you.
Some complicated real-world circumstances she describes there. So break this down for me. What exactly do I need to have to be prepared?
The first big category is identification and proof of residence. So you're going to want to have a valid ID. That's going to be critical for aid applications. So put copies of whatever you have, your driver's license, a passport, a visa, a green card, naturalization papers, in your disaster kit. And if anything is close to expiring, you're going to want to make an appointment to get that renewed. That's just not something you're going to be able to do easily after a disaster occurs. And then proof of residence, that can get a little bit trickier, especially if you're a renter. So someone might be able to use a mortgage statement or a lease agreement, but if you are rent somewhere where you're not formally on the lease, you can put a couple pieces of mail, like utility bills, that demonstrate your proof of address in your kit, or even a note, perhaps, from your landlord. That could be helpful.
And proof of residency is also something that that's needed for aid applications, I presume.
Yes, and it's also going to be really important if you live in an area that's closed by authorities after a disaster. So in order to get back into your neighborhood or your house, you're going to need something that says, I live here, and be able to prove that.
So what are some other things we might have to prove or demonstrate with documents after a disaster?
Right. So for FEMA and many other aid applications, the burden of proof is on you. So you're going to have to be able to prove how a disaster damaged your home and belongings. So you're going to want to be able to show before and after, right? And the emergency legal responders recommend taking short, like 10-second videos of your house and everything in it that you could easily upload or send to your contacts if you need to. So timestamp those videos so it's clear that they're taken before the disaster, and then get the big structural elements of your home, windows, floors, walls, doors, but also anything that you might want to replace. So like laptops, medicine in your medicine cabinet, or food in your pantry or fridge. And again, this is an important step even if you don't own your home, because if you rent, having this documentation could make it more helpful or easier for you to resolve any disputes that come up with your landlord about repairs after a disaster. And then this is one that really surprised me, pets. Pets need a lot of paperwork as well. So if your pet runs away or gets separated from you during a disaster and is later brought to a shelter or a vet clinic, you can't just take your pet home. You need to be able to prove that you own that animal in order to be reunited with them. And Brandi Shimabukuro with the Hawaiian Humane Society says this can be done with vet records, with your pet's microchip number, even pictures of you with your pet. But again, simply identifying your pet is not going to be enough.
Having something that says this pet has a history with your family is so important. We have lots of poi dogs. We have lots of mixed breed cats that are out there in the community. Oftentimes, just being able to say, hey, that's my pet, that looks like my pet. The reality is we want to make sure that that's backed up with documentation to ensure they're going to the right family and not devastating somebody else who might have a pet that looks very similar to them.
All right. Thankfully, I think most people do have pictures of themselves with their pets. That's a good thing. What other tips would you offer up for us?
Yeah, redundancy is a big one. So you want to make sure that your information is safe and accessible in multiple places. Amelia Hoppe shared this heartbreaking story of someone she met in Maui who had lost everything. But the one saving grace was that the bookkeeping for their business was in Asheville, North Carolina after the fires. But a couple of months after they had that conversation, Hurricane Helene hit North Carolina and destroyed those records as well. And that sounds like a really extreme example, but the emergency legal responders say with the way climate change is exacerbating disasters, it's just not outside of the realm of possibility that you could be impacted not just by one, but multiple disasters. So you have to think that way when you're preparing. Diversify where your information is. Have multiple physical copies of paperwork in different safe places and upload digital copies somewhere secure. And then it's a good idea to make sure a trusted person also knows how to access that if you cannot.
Yeah. Remote access, very important. All right. So the very fundamental question, Savannah, have you, now that you've done all this reporting, taken the steps that you're asking us all to take? Be honest.
Yes.
All right.
Yes, I have. And to preface, I am not an organized person. There's something that in my house is lovingly known as the rat drawer, and that's where I put every item I own. That's the closest thing I have to a system. So I'm really sympathetic if this is something that's not natural for people to do. I sat down, knuckled through it. Took me, I would say, 3 or 4 hours. Amelia Hoppe with Emergency Legal Responders says, think of it like your taxes. You know, put it on your calendar. Give yourself a deadline. One of her other colleagues, Eliza McDermott, said, have a party. Invite people over. Do this together. Whatever you need to do to feel like you can get it done, make sure that it happens, because this is something that we do have control over. There's so much that happens in a disaster that we can't control, but this thing, we can take some time to be more prepared. And HawaiiPublicRadio.org has a checklist to help you get started on this process.
Yeah, that's a great point. It empowers us, right? We're always looking for more ways to control things in our life. And it's probably something that's not fun to think about. But once you've done it, it feels good to know it is done. Thank you so much, Savannah, for this reporting. We will have that checklist she mentioned on our website later today at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA, celebrating over 87 years of dedication in supporting the health and well-being of the people of Hawaii with a commitment to caring for the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
Join us for Live from the Atherton, our flagship event series celebrating music, culture, and community. This February, we honor mele as living tradition as part of Mihina Olalo Hawaii. This year's performances feature Gregory Wan, Lady Laritza, Kiana Li'i o Mana'e, Bertelman, and Aine. Live from the Atherton is sponsored by HMSA. For more information, go to hprtickets.org.
Support for HPR comes from Costco Air Conditioning and Refrigeration, featuring Daikin Air Conditioning Systems. Listing of contractors installing Daikin products, that's D-A-I-K-I-N, at CostcoHawaii.com.
Mockingbirds will be brought to the territory this month by Hui Manu. That's a headline from a 1931 edition of the Honolulu Star Bulletin. Back then, it was popular to purposely introduce non-native species. 95 years later, you can still find a few northern mockingbirds in the islands. University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart tells you what to look for. We've got the songs of these mockingbirds thanks to the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology. Here's your Manu Minute.
Mockingbirds are a recognizable part of the bird world in North and Central America, but many people in Hawaii don't know that we have them here as well. They mostly live in dry woodland habitats on the leeward side of all of our islands. And even there, generally aren't very common. Mockingbirds are not native to Hawaii. They were introduced in the 1920s as a songbird and for insect control. About the size of mynas, but with a longer tail, they're gray, with dark wings that have bright white patches that can only be seen when they fly. One of the most interesting things about mockingbirds is that they can learn hundreds of different songs, and often mimic the sounds of other species of birds, as well as frogs, crickets, dogs, car alarms, and squeaky gates. See if you can recognize who or what this mockingbird is trying to mimic. Why do mockingbirds do this? Most likely because females prefer males that are the most fit and have the best genes to pass down to their offspring. And the best way for males to show females how fit they are is through their song repertoire. Males that can mimic a large variety of different songs and sounds are showing that they're stronger and more experienced than those with smaller repertoires. In support of this idea, one recent study found that while male mockingbirds sang throughout the year, they produce the greatest variety of song types when they're courting females just prior to breeding. Some of our native Hawaiian bird species, such as the apapane, are also known to mimic other species, but none as well as the northern mockingbird. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the Hilo Biology Department.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Ken and Patty Kupchak for the Friends of Oahu National Wildlife Refuges, devoted to helping protect the native species that call the refuges their home. Friendsofoahunwr.org.
All the books.
Mary Mao's memoir entitled Tricked tells the troubling, moving story of her decades as a trafficked sex worker. Her journey began as a teenager, when shortly after her mother's suicide, Mao moved to New York with a man who controlled her movements and forced her into sex work. She was eventually arrested for prostitution and served time on Rikers Island. Later, she managed to escape New York and moved to Hawaii with her young daughter, but she was still trapped in her life as a sex worker. Leaving that world took a complete transformation in her 40s, and she writes about this journey in her book, which was co-authored with local author Mary Putnam. We spoke with Mao and Putnam about the book and their collaboration. Mao starts off by describing how she hopes her story can reach those who have had their own experiences being trafficked. And a note, this interview features heavy themes of violence and suicide.
Well, what I'd truly like them to get from this, to take away with, is especially these young adolescents, and nowadays it's 10, 12, 13, 4, it's really young. It's a whole new world, because this is back in the early 70s. I would love to let them know exactly what to expect and see all the red flags and help them and know there's help and that they're not alone and there's people out there. And I want to do the best I can do before I leave this planet. That's why I'm here. I was in the life for almost 40 years. So, yeah.
So this is in part sort of an effort to bring people into this world, to shine a light on this world, but also sharing stories that are deeply personal to you, that are, in fact, your own life story.
And it's also about faith, and it's a combination of things. It's not just one thing in particular.
Mary Putnam, you worked on this book along with Mary Mao. Talk to us about how you were brought into this process.
Sure. So Mary actually knew several HPD officers on sort of a casual basis, some from the gym, some from the street, because if she would see a young girl on the streets of Waikiki and there was something that she could do to stop them from getting sucked into the life as soon as possible, she was absolutely doing that. So my husband was also in law enforcement and knew these HPD guys. They all worked for the state of Hawaii, the special agent for the attorney general's office. My husband knew this other retired HPD cop that had found out from Mary that she wanted to write this book and share it with the world, share her amazing story. So the two of them started talking, but of course, Mary not so comfortable necessarily with law enforcement or with men. So when I begged to tag along one time, we hit it off. We were just talking story and having a good time. So I shoved the husband out of the way and said, I'll do it.
Yeah.
But what was so impressive to me about her story is, given the little bits I was finding out, you would think that she would be angry and bitter or dead like many of her coworkers. So the fact that after all that she'd been through, she was still so funny and warm and full of light. I had to learn more, and I hope I did the story justice.
Mary Mao, 40 years living in a trafficked world, what made you feel ready to tell this story?
Right before I met Mary, I had been in the life. I was 40, 48, 49 at the time. And imagine, in that world, you know, you're 15 or you're 20 year old, right? So imagine 49. The only reason I was able to still make money is because I knew what I knew. I could have been 149. It didn't matter. So that wasn't the problem. It wasn't the pimps, or it wasn't the rapes, or it wasn't drugs, or it wasn't the bad customers. I got into a point where I knew nothing but that life, but I didn't know what to do. I couldn't talk to cops, so I thought, because they're going to try to do something wrong. I couldn't talk to the street people because they're going to try to rob me or play me some kind of way. Or I couldn't talk to other girls because they're going to try to bring me home to their guy. So here I was with all these decades, and finally I'm losing it and I don't know what to do. And I stayed in my house for almost 2 years in darkness. I started collecting animals. And I know in my heart, I started collecting animals because I didn't care about myself, honestly. I knew I had to take care of these animals. So that was keeping me alive. Not that I didn't have a child or a grandchild, but they were in another state. And in that state of mind, sometimes out of sight, out of mind, but these animals were in my sight. So that's what first started to get me. But then after 2 years, I knew that I was going to die. I was withered down to almost 100 pounds. And I was on my knees begging God to help me. What do I do? I don't know what to do anymore. So I got up and I walked to the nearest clinic and I started my journey from that day on.
That's all so remarkable in terms of all of the aspects of that journey. But even still, I feel like there's a large gap between that place you just described arriving at and being able and willing to share your story written down for everyone. Does that feel like the next natural leap for you?
So you have to remember, a lot of people don't know this world. I wasn't able to speak to anybody but a customer for 10 years. So imagine I'm 14 years old, from 14 to 24 years old, not being able to talk to nobody but a customer. Only that, no friends, no buddies, no nobody. Only that one, my handler or whatever you want to call it. And that was it. I wasn't allowed to call home. I wasn't allowed to do anything. So I'm already brainwashed for them 10 years in that mindset. So basically, I didn't start talking until I changed my life. And that was kind of hard. After it was 38 years, who do I talk to? How do these people even know me? You know? But I kept my good heart. At the end of the day, I kept my good heart. They couldn't take that from me, you know? I've had over 22 surgeries trying to look a certain way. Everything's fake on me but my heart. You know, people know they can get through it. And there's only a smidgen of things in that book. And they're going to see you can get through it. I have so much light left, you know?
Mary Putnam, I'm curious about your experience with the task of taking such a dynamic and difficult story and bringing it to readers with a sense of reality, but also sensitivity. Talk about balancing all of those aspects and how you found the way to best bring Mary Mal's story to readers.
That's a good question, because it's a little different than most memoirs are sort of one section of someone's life, right? Kind of by definition. But her life was so amazing, and there's so much that we couldn't put in there, including we decided not to mention some of the famous people that have been her.
Oh, that's a whole nother book.
So names were changed to prevent or protect the guilty and so forth. So what I think we did is to sort of touch down, you know, if you're flying over a large country and then touch down and get into certain key moments. For example, it opens with her mom's suicide. And frankly, this is a little bit of a secret that we might not need to tell everybody, but my husband's a crime writer. And so a couple of times when there was a really difficult scene where I had no experience, I had this charmed, perfect life going to beautiful schools and living, growing up in the islands and whatnot. So I would ask my husband, like, hey, I don't want to, I've never been in a knife fight. I've never had someone pointing that at me. Could you write this scene? And so it was actually sort of a three-way collaboration with him writing the really difficult part. And then I would try to make it sound like Mary. And we did multiple recordings over and over again. I would listen to her voice and try to really walk in her shoes.
See, the thing is, I had a terrible childhood before I even hit the streets. I seen the worst thing I could possibly see before I hit them streets. So anything after that, I believe, not that I was trying to be this person, but I was, this is what my cards were dealt, that anything after what my mother did, then I was already strong.
It sounds very true, the point you've made, and difficult, sad that you were from the start made to gather that strength as an individual.
Well, that's it. And here's the happy part. You ready? Here where it goes up. At the end of the day, everything that I went through, I would do it all over again. Her weakness is my strength. She was so weak, and that's okay. There's a story in the book about my daughter, and that's my favorite story in the book. And you understand it. I would do it all over again just to have my daughter.
Yeah. Mary Putnam, through the process of working on this book, tell us something that you feel like you learned. I'm sure there might have been many things, but what stands out for you in your memory of working on the pages of the book about a way in which your own eyes were opened?
Well, I didn't realize the term trafficking is kind of misleading because it implies movement, but you can be trafficked without having gone anywhere, just even in your own home. Sometimes girls are trafficked by their own family members. And
yes.
Also, just because you're not physically shackled to something, the brainwashing mm-hmm. is going to keep you stuck. So, for example, you know, Mary Mao, part of her brainwashing and the damage that she suffered was this lack of confidence to think, can I do something else? Can I just walk away? Can I leave this man? So it's, there's so many levels to it that people don't realize. And the other thing is, a lot of times people think, oh, human trafficking or sex trafficking, that's somewhere else. But no, it's right here in our own neighborhoods happening now. And to just not talk about it is a huge disservice. This is our children we're talking about, younger every year. And we have to talk about it. It's Human Trafficking Awareness Month, as you probably know, for January. So now's the time to talk about it and read Mary's book, because it's funny.
That's what kept me sane, you know, humor. I had to learn people. I had to learn people. I had to figure people from a distance. I had to work it out here. Otherwise, I would be dead. So I learned cultures and people and this and that. I might not have a school education, but I absolutely have a human being education, you know?
For sure. Maybe one last like sort of thought. I don't know. What's your hope for the book? And I know that's a very generic question, but you worked so hard on it for so long. It's such an important story.
I can tell you exactly. And I've said this to several people, and I know you don't know me personally, but from my heart, if I pass tomorrow, from my heart, I want these children to know they can be okay. And there's life after whatever. Do you understand? There's people out there to help them. People will embrace them, no matter what. Boys, too. People aren't talking about the young boys. People are here to help them. You know, that's the main thing. And I wanted to get it out there and see that, know that they could surpass all this stuff. That's it.
That was Mary Mao, author of Tricked, along with the co-author of the book, Mary Putnam. There'll be a book discussion and signing this Sunday at Barnes & Noble and the Ala Moana Center in Honolulu. Head to our website today for more details about the event. It's called Noise Cabinet, and it's a new musical performance series at the Capitol Modern. The first installment will be this weekend. It's the brainchild of musician Clara Kim, and the idea is to create a series for listeners with openness and curiosity about music and sounds they have yet to experience. We spoke with Kim about her vision for the series and what listeners can expect.
Noise Cabinet. It's kind of a funny name, but I thought of it because, well, it would be wonderful to have a platform where artists can just share whatever's on their mind, maybe something they've been working on or a couple of new pieces, and to feature different artists. And something that I've been continuing to discover is just the incredible possibility in music, in classical music. As a kid, growing up and sort of learning about the canon, that was amazing. And then later on, I felt like there is so much other stuff beyond that. And that's what I hope to sort of explore through this new concert series.
I think in general with music, people can get stuck in a rut, right? I mean, right. This is sort of a cliche. Parents always, you know, talk about the songs from their youth, right?
Yeah.
It's absolutely more acute with classical music, this issue, right?
That's
because
right.
Those well-known composers, those well-known pieces, they circulate and circulate yeah. and sort of elbow out all the other possibilities.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I love them too. Don't get me wrong. I absolutely love them. But I think now, even more so, the ability to create something new and something rich and something truly relevant to how we walk through our world, what we experience around us, how we want to represent our culture and what sorts of music we leave behind, to have that be a part of this new tapestry that we're continuing on from that amazing tradition that we have. I think there are so many talented composers out there, and I'm just always itching to hear different points of view, you know, exploring new kinds of sounds. And I think it's really exciting to be able to do that and to do it at a time when I feel like the world is our oyster when we think about globalization and the ability to reach people from all corners of the earth and to learn from each other. In the end, I hope it's also a wonderful way to bring the community together and to experience something new in the moment together and to share that incredible experience that music can bring.
I really like how you framed that, and even that you brought the word globalization into it, because I think when we go to conversations about globalization, it's often, without us necessarily realizing it, a conversation about the globalization of economic systems, money, right? Flow of money. But there are so many different ways for cultures, artists, individuals to interact with each other, and music is just one of them, right?
Right.
And that's something that sounds like you're capturing here.
Yeah. It's really inspiring to learn from different cultures and to bring those little bits of memories and experiences that we might have from traveling or from talking to somebody else who has grown up in a different place on the earth. And I think those little bits are the things that kind of help us all grow and learn from each other. And so I would love that to be a part of the conversation that we have, because it's something that's real. It's something that we all experience, and hopefully something that we all, you know, when we come to it with curiosity, it can help us grow in very, very, I think, wonderful and unique ways.
Nothing better than curiosity at making you feel alive too, right? That's when
yes.
You feel most alive. Well, talk a little bit about the format for Noise Cabinet, how the evenings are going to be formatted. Will each be different, or is there an approach you're taking in terms of structuring the evening?
Yeah, so we'll have, you know, about an hour of music. And within that hour, it'll be curated. We'll see, you know, how the series develops. But what I would love to start off with is featuring maybe one or two different artists for each show. So for the upcoming show this Saturday, we have two incredible artists who I'm very, very excited to share their works with everybody. They are Leiluhua Lanzilotti and Gaylord DeWalt. And they are just very beautiful people and beautiful musicians. So the first set, the first half of the show will feature four pieces by Leiluhua. And then the back half of the concert will feature Gaylord DeWalt, who is a beautiful, wonderful free jazz improviser. And at the end, we'll kind of all get together and play something together.
And the we in that is you, right?
That's
you're,
right.
You're joining them. So when you've put together the programs for these two first iterations of Noise Cabinet, how much of it is about the relationship between the two artists, their work? Is a lot of your vision for what listeners will experience in terms of how those two artists, how their sounds interact? Or is it sort of more or less part A, part B, just sort of side by side?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. For me, I really want it to be an experience from the beginning to the end. So even though the sets are divided into two halves, I want it to feel like something that's interactive between the different music that is being prepared and explored. So for Leiluhua and Gaylord, I think both of them have wonderful sound worlds that sort of overlap with each other. So I want the audience and the listeners to sort of experience that as a through line. They're both extremely sort of colorful and sensitive musicians. And so I think that this first concert will be something really, really special in the sound and in the color and the timbre. The second concert, the one in March, will feature two very different artists, but I think there will be a thematic overlap that I want to express in highlighting one of the pieces, which is called Second Nature by Christopher Stark. And that is a piece that uses a field recording of cicadas in northern Thailand. And so I wanted to highlight that component. And so I gathered with the other featured artist, which is the Galliard Strings from Chamber Music Hawaii, and gathered a few other pieces that we could complement Chris's larger work with. And so the chamber music pieces with Galliard Strings will also highlight themes of nature and ocean, one about an evergreen tree. And so there'll be some overlap there. And I think those worlds might be sort of complementary, but in the end, it'll sort of tie together as well.
Field recordings of cicadas. I don't think that's something that Brahms or Beethoven ever gave us as listeners. It's a great example, too, of what one can be exposed to when one opens oneself up to new music. The whole motivation for this series is curiosity, right? An openness to new sounds. Are there other examples that come to mind in terms of things that you're curious about, sounds that you're curious about, that you hope in the future to bring to listeners?
Yeah, so I'll actually start with one example that I was really moved by that we'll be playing this Saturday. One of Leilihua's works is based on a poem by M.S. Merwin, who lived on Maui for quite a bit of time and kind of redid and regrew this incredible plot of land there. And he tried all these different plants after the soil had been, you know, basically bare. And finally, he found one palm tree that kind of worked. And from there, he grew this incredible palm tree garden. And one of the poems and this experience that Leilihua had being in residence at the Merwin Conservancy, you know, she took that experience and put it into this piece. And that's one of the solo works that I'll be playing for the inaugural concert. And I think that is, for me, a really beautiful way of how culture and how her heritage and her connection with the land here can be something that we can learn from and experience from through her music. So thinking of different sounds, I would love to experience those kinds of real, tangible ways that people walk through life and experience life. I think one of the other things that I would love to try to bring to the series over the long term is just a wide range of sound. So from solo music to chamber music works, I hope eventually to maybe even get like a septet or an octet in there, which would be like just incredible to be so close to such a sort of semi-large group. And then also on the other side, from purely acoustic stuff to electroacoustic material, things that might have electronics involved and sort of integrated into the performance.
I know from your concert at the Atherton and speaking to you about that, how collaboration is so front and center for you. And it's clear in this project here, Noise Cabinet, as well. And at first, it seems like that collaboration is all about the event itself, the artists that will be coming together for that hour and presenting music. But I get the feeling talking to you here that there's also the possibility that each of these iterations of Noise Cabinet could inspire new collaborations, that new things could be found.
Yeah. So that's one of the things, you're totally right, that really sparks me and just really inspires me is just by finding out how people work and also by inspiring new collaborations and new ideas and new projects. And I think this is one of the richest ways to sort of experience the life, you know, as a musician, is to keep looking for those things and those things that might be beyond our sort of immediate world. So however much as is possible to reach across the aisle and to learn and to engage and create something new and beautiful together, I think that's one of the most incredible things.
That was musician Clara Kim talking about Noise Cabinet, a new music series she is curating at the Capitol Modern. We'll have details for Saturday's concert on our website later today. Head over to YouTube to catch a video of Kim's August performance in our Live from the Atherton series. That's it for today. Up tomorrow, we mark the 50th anniversary of the month that activists landed on Ko'olawe to protest bombings by the U.S. Navy. We revisit interviews with those at the forefront of the movement to take back the island. Give us some feedback. Call our talkback line at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Want to listen back to something you've heard? Find the conversation on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm D.W. Gibson in for Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.